to you. So I'm going to move on now to Professor John Wolfe, who has been working in collaboration with Professor Arthur Burns and Dr. Bill Jacob on the Building on History project, which has had a national focus, but also worked with certain local areas of the country. John is professor at the Open University, and he is going to and has just recently published a short history of global evangelicalism. Short history, he says anything about that. But also of interest probably is his editorial work on the Yorkshire Religious Census. So John, I'm going to, without further ado, I'm going to ask you to present the project to us.
Thank you very much, Dee. On the 21st of February 1900, in St Paul's Cathedral, Bishop Mandel Crichton delivered his first and what proved to be his last visitation charge to the clergy of the Diocese of London. He began by reflecting briefly on the particular challenges of his own position and of London itself, but quickly moved on to focus on current ecclesiastical controversies, especially the nature of Holy Communion and the practice of confession. Crichton had been a historian long before he became a bishop, and it was therefore natural that his response to contemporary issues should rapidly move into an insightful lecture on Reformation history. His analysis was both specific and general. For example, he pointed out that breakfast was not normally eaten in medieval and early modern societies, and so congregations naturally came fasting to a late morning communion service. In changed social circumstances, it would be inappropriate, he said, to revive this custom as an absolute law. More broadly, he observed, antiquity has a charm to many minds, especially when it can be viewed from a safe distance and is seen through the haze of sentiment. It is hard to distinguish between what upholds and what weakens the permanent elements of character, between truth and fancy, between what is necessary to explain the truth and what fritters away its supreme claim on the intelligence as well as on the feelings. On the other hand, it is easy to attempt the impossible task of avoiding past dangers by the apparently simple process of cutting oneself adrift from the past altogether and hoping to remake human nature by starving its finer side out of existence. And Crichton, for his part, advocated the upholding of the via media of the true temple of the Church of England, which could only be ascertained by careful inquiry. Crichton's observations well encapsulate an abiding ambivalence to the Church of England's attitude to history that still rings true a century later. This paper, however, draws on the experience of recent collaboration between historians and church leaders in Crichton's own diocese to inform reflection on the current relationship between academic church history and practitioners on the ground. A lack of effective integration remains apparent despite the distinguished tradition of church historical study by Anglican clergy and committed lay people. Clergy, most notably the Chadwick brothers, have continued to scale the heights of academic recognition, while conversely, serious historians from Henry Hart Milman in the mid-19th century to Bill Jacob in our own day have held senior positions in the church. The present Archbishop of Canterbury is an eloquent advocate for the importance of history in contemporary Christian thinking. On the other hand, the indications are that insights from such scholarship do not readily permeate into the thinking of a church at grassroots. In theological and ministerial training, church history often appears something of a Cinderella subject, sometimes taught by non-specialists and struggling to maintain its foothold in the curriculum. There's an interesting contrast here, I think, with the training of army officers. The Royal Military Academy Sandhurst describes, quote, modern military history as a key component of an army officer's training. And one of the institution's three main departments is war studies, with 14 members, most of whom are historians. The course includes a two-day trip to Normandy, during which cadets examine real tactical level scenarios from the 1944 campaign. 20th century specialisms predominate among the staff, but there were some with interests in the Revolutionary and Napoleonic Wars. If the British Army deems it useful for officers likely shortly to be commanding units in contemporary Afghanistan to have a detailed on-the-ground understanding of battles fought over 60 years ago, and at least some awareness of more remote military history, it would seem suggestive, at least by analogy, of potential more mainstream and practical applications for history in the contemporary church. It was with such considerations in mind that in 2007, in collaboration with Arthur Burns of King's College London, and in partnership with the Diocese of London and Lambeth Palace Library, I submitted an application to the ARCHSE's Knowledge Transfer Scheme for a project on modern religious history and the contemporary church. The Diocese of London seemed an especially appropriate partner for such a venture, in view of its strategic location, rich history of innovation, and recent record of significant church growth, against the trend of continuing overall Anglican decline. The focus of the project was on the 19th and early 20th centuries, reflecting both the expertise of the applicants and a sense that significant and meaningful analogies could be drawn to the present, especially in respect of the impact of large-scale migration on religious life in the metropolis. The venture also received enthusiastic support from the diocesan bishop, Richard Charters, and committed day-to-day involvement from Archdeacon Bill Jacob. Lambeth Palace Library were involved as a further partner as the main depository for the papers of successive bishops of London, although much relevant archival material, especially for parish historians, is also held by the Guildhall Library and the London Metropolitan Archives. There have been two main strands of activity. First, an online resource guide has been developed, designed to provide accessible guidance for those with historical interests but without formal historical training, who want to investigate London church history for its own sake, or in order to contextualise a present-day situation or problem. Users are encouraged to begin with easily accessible activities, such as reading the building of their local church before plunging into the archives. And so an analogy here with Helen's idea of being church detectives, which she was talking about earlier. We encourage people to sort of develop an initial approach of sort of look, listen, read, and only then sort of move into more detailed archival research. The resource guide is complemented by material prepared by Neil Evans, Director of Professional Development in the Diocese, on what have been termed history audits for parishes. A history audit is not a systematic parish history, but rather a focused endeavour to uncover historical issues and themes that remain relevant to contemporary ministry. For example, the physical situation of church buildings imposes specific opportunities and constraints that may well be usefully understood in a historical context. There are indications that patterns of congregational behaviour in attitudes, for example, to clergy, money or neighbouring churches may unwittingly be transmitted across the generations. Second, the web-based material has been complemented by a series of face-to-face presentations and discussions. Members of the team visited a majority of the 23 deaneries in the diocese and have also contributed to a variety of clergy and lay training events. There was a presentation to the Diocesan Synod in December 2009 and a presentation on interim insights to a gathering of invited senior clergy in December 2010. During the final phase of the project in 2011, there were three regional presentations to other dioceses, and a final London event exploring the religious diversity of the East End of London and seeking to apply the insights gained to other Christian and non-Christian religious traditions. In the rest of this presentation, I'd like mainly to summarise some key points made in presentations to church audiences, and thus also offering a short survey of some of relevant literature, and reflect on the implications for how we approach academic, ecclesiastical and parish history. A particular focus in our discussions with church leaders has been questioning the narrative of secularisation, at least as presented in its starkest form, most notably by the sociologist Steve Bruce. Attention has been drawn to the evidence that church attendance was never, in the last two centuries, anything approaching universal, at least not in London. Audiences have been given examples of significant religious vitality in the period, notably the massive church building and home mission initiatives undertaken during the episcopates of Charles Bloomfield and Archibald Campbell Tait in the mid-19th century, and the later 45 Churches Fund, providing places of worship for newly suburbanised northwest London in the 1920s and 30s. Such initiatives, they have been reminded, need to be evaluated in an informed historical context, rather than by potentially anachronistic 21st century criteria, or by judgment on long-term legacies that obscure substantial medium-term achievements. Moreover, popular attitudes have been characterised as not wholly secular, but rather as manifesting what has been called a diffusive Christianity, or vicarious religion, and a non-specific supernaturalism that was conducive to maintaining residual links with the churches through rites of passage and was potentially responsive to effective mission. Hence, the church presence has been presented as one of change and fluctuation rather than of inexorable decline. Attention has thus been drawn to the historical importance of individual agency in determining the trajectories of parishes, which sometimes look very different from those of near neighbours with similar socio-economic conditions. Present-day leaders have therefore been urged to see themselves as more the masters of their own destiny than the victims of events and social forces beyond their control. Indeed, it has been suggested that the perception of failure among clergy led to a self-fulfilling crisis of morale in the earlier 20th century, while in the 1960s and 1970s, the diocese's sense that it was managing decline led to premature and short-sighted closures of churches. Rex Walford has a lovely line in his book on the churches in 20th century North London, where he comments that Graham Leonard, as a suffragan bishop, had beeching-like tendencies. Granted that the later 20th century cultural changes characterised by Callum Brown as the death of Christian Britain have reinforced a sense of challenge to traditional church structures, the argument that an alternative narrative is possible has been given plausibility in London by the substantial rise in electoral roll membership since 1990. A linked point has been encouragement to reflect on the historical contingency of current structures. We've heard something about the change of local government boundaries in this part of the country earlier on. A similar point could be made about the Diocese of London in its current form being something of an accident of history. Since ancient times, the Thames has marked the southern boundary of the diocese, and that has obviously implications for any kind of strategy for London as a whole. And more recently, in the later 19th and early 20th centuries, division of the historic Diocese of London by the creation successively of St Albans and Chelmsford further sort of truncated what was the original area. There's legitimate debate to be had as to whether this arrangement serves the church in contemporary London better than a single enormous metropolitan diocese would do. But such a discussion can be usefully informed by an awareness of the context and rationale for original decisions regarding the current structure. Similar points can be made at local level, where legal and personal factors made it much easier in the 19th century to plant new churches by division and subdivision within existing parishes, rather than by more strategic reorganisation involving two or more parishes. Hence, for example, the northwest London suburb of Cricklewood lacks any Anglican church on its main street, because that was the historic boundary between the ancient parishes of Hendon and Wilsdon. A further emphasis has been on the value of looking at past controversies as a means of inducing a sense of proportion in current internal Anglican arguments over particularly women bishops and homosexual clergy. It tends to come as a surprise to current leaders that passions in the 19th century ran quite as high over the theology of baptism and then over ritualism, which was seen by opponents as subverting the essential character of the Church of England. There's also a consistency in frustration regarding the pastoral consequences of such disputes. Crichton's words in 1900 have a strikingly contemporary resonance. Whatever may be your opinion about the importance of the points at issue or about the need for controversy, you will all agree with me in thinking that the diversion of energy from practical work and the appearance of disunion and dissension are in themselves disastrous, and that true wisdom demands that we should consider how suspicion can be allayed and the church be able to resume its proper task of working peacefully for the highest interest of the people. History, of course, doesn't offer straightforward models for conflict resolution, but it does offer ample illustration of the negative consequences of introverted preoccupation with internal arguments, but also, more positively, of a propensity of Anglicans eventually to learn to live creatively with even quite radical differences. Finally, the project has highlighted the potentialities of history for raising the profile of churches in their communities through collaboration with local historians, and there are obvious links here to some of the other presentations we've had this morning. The online resource guide has been designed to support such activity and was complemented in October 2010 by a well-attended workshop targeted particularly at this constituency. The endeavour has been to encourage and assist good practice in the writing of parish history, through in particular awareness of a wider historiographical context and encouragement of wide community involvement. For example, young people might be enlisted to conduct all history interviews with older members of congregations, or a whole village participate in research endeavours, as was in the case in a particularly impressive project at Littlebury in Essex. Church schools offer a further channel for wider community engagement, with encouragement to use the church building itself as a very valuable resource for teaching about Christian and community history, an idea we successfully piloted at Christchurch in Hampstead. What then are the implications of this experience for academic historians of Christianity? The potential dangers should first be acknowledged. There's an obvious tension between the academic insistence on balance and nuance and the understandable interest of clergy on the ground in gaining clear-cut insights into immediate pastoral and practical problems. Awareness of the risks was heightened when one West London clergyman apparently told his local paper that our project showed that church-going is as popular at the present time as in the Victorian era. A seriously distorted representation of the evidence we presented at the seminar he attended. More subtly, it proves difficult to get busy people to move on from taking away a single big idea, such as, say, the importance of clergy leadership, or the problematic nature of a conventional secularisation narrative, to spend time on developing a more informed engagement with the history. There's also the prima facie objection that an aspiration for historians actually to assist the work of a contemporary church risks compromising objectivity and detachment. Such thinking, though, would surely seem strange to colleagues in university engineering departments who see direct connections between their work and actual construction projects, and also, in a more cognate field, to art historians who are used to collaborating with galleries and museums. If there's a difficulty for church historians, it surely lies not on the level of principle, but rather of wider practical experience in establishing the ground rules for such associations in a way that is responsive to the needs and capabilities of all parties. The prospect that research in British universities would in future be assessed for its, quote, impacts on the economy, society and or culture constitutes a further incentive to the grasping of this nettle. However, this line of development also offers exciting potential to stimulate new thinking about the history of the church. There's intriguing potential to build on conversations with present-day church leaders to form new hypotheses about institutional and organisational constraints on historical development, which can then productively be explored and tested in the archives. For example, a forthcoming study of church growth in London links historical to contemporary experience. Analysis of the role of church buildings in Finchley links archival research on their original construction and 19th century development to consideration of their present-day utilisation. Moreover, it's hoped that if the project succeeds in its aim of stimulating and facilitating more rigorous community-based research at the parish level, this will, in years to come, provide building blocks for academic analysis of grassroots church life that is more sensitive than hitherto to the rich tapestry of varied local experience. A development of a project for which we've received some further follow-on funding from the HRC will encompass other Christian traditions and Jews and Muslims and further extend the potentialities for gaining fresh understanding of the historic roles of religion in local communities. Above all, such conversations offer potential for better understanding of the dynamics of the church's relationship to its own history. Past historians, from John Fox to Richard Church, have been highly influential in fostering partisan readings of history, alongside the liberal Anglican tradition represented by Mandel Crichton, which has sought to provide historical legitimacy for claims of Anglican comprehensiveness. more recent historians, whether churchmen or academics, conscious of the constraints of modern scientific history, have tried to avoid such ulterior agendas. Arguably, however, while church history has gained in objectivity, it has lost in obvious relevance to the needs of practitioners. Institutional loss of memory in the later 20th century church is itself a historical phenomenon well worthy of study, and may provide a worthwhile perspective on the wider sense of terminal religious crisis characteristic of the period. However, the deficiency is also one which is worth seeking to correct in the future by emphasising the value of history, not as a resource for perpetuating past battles, but rather as one for stimulating creative innovation in pastoral and community engagement. It's important not to have the illusion that the task is a straightforward or short-term one. The Building on History project has benefited from substantial public funding, an able and committed team, enthusiastic collaborators, and the direct personal interest of both the Bishop of London and the Archbishop of Canterbury. Nevertheless, after 3 years' work, it's done more to pose questions and chart a direction of travel than to achieve widespread change in the Church of England's attitude to history. There's much more to be done, particularly in seeking to embed its ideas in the training and thinking of future clergy and lay leaders, a task that will require a wider commitment of parish historians as well as of the church itself. And on the final slide, contact details, a web link, unfortunately isn't showing very well, to our website, which will give you access to the online resource guide. And I've also brought with me a number of copies of the project report, which we recently produced, which are freely available to anybody who promises to read it. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much indeed, John. Another very encouraging example of partnership. Any questions? I was very interested to see that on one of your days you had sessions for parish and local historians.
Yes.
And that obviously this was answering one of the questions, or helping started to answer one of the questions we had earlier about encouraging partnership between local historians who all hold so much material and parish churches which haven't, and clergy who haven't been encouraged to think seriously about history. Can you suggest some other ways forward possibly on this, or what are you doing to take this forward?
Well, that particular event was a one-off, but a very successful one-off. I mean, it was actually, I mean, hosted by the Diocese of London as our partners, and in quite widely publicised. We, I think, we had about 50 or 60 people there, and I think the format was one we'd very much recommend. Presentations from more academic historians taking a wider view of the kind of sort of contextual issues Helen was talking about with the timeline, and then having a series of case studies of a sort of variety of good practice and experience of how one is actually doing it on the ground. Talk about practical experience of gaining HLF funding, for example, for parish history, and the idea of engaging young people as oral history researchers. A sharing of ideas, but it took quite a bit of organisation, and it was something we did once, but weren't in a position to repeat on a regular basis. So I think we have put the some of the information about it on the website. I think one thing that prompted us to do it was the awareness that there are still some rather grim sort of local church histories being written out there, either by the sense of of architecture without an awareness of the people in the building, or very much sort of wedded to the narrative of inexorable church decline, which in many ways we would want at least to problematise.